Well, last week we wound up our study in the first paragraph of chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians. So this evening we're going to start a short paragraph, verses 13, 14, and 15, second paragraph in the chapter. In the previous paragraph, the basic focus for the 12 verses was heavily invested in the themes that involved around the day of the Lord, and why the day of the Lord and the disappearance that he talked about were not overlapping. In Paul's explanation of why the day of the Lord hadn't yet come, he went straight into the man of sin, the mystery of the lawlessness, and all of that, and then reaction of God to that. And in our study last time, we saw the final outcome of God's reaction, that he's actually going to set up a situation so that people will be deceived by believing what's a lie because they didn't have any commitment to truth. They didn't want the truth. And in verse 12, it says they actually took pleasure in their unrighteous behavior. So when a person gets into that mode, then God does react. So the response of God in that paragraph is, in a word, judgment. But this judgment comes in a variety of ways. And one of those variety of ways is God's response to the attitudes of those who are committed to unrighteousness, because it's about their lack of interest in the truth and their taking pleasure in hurting other people just so they can have their way. And another aspect of the judgment is God's actual physical response to the behavior that those attitudes drive. So he's actually going to physically respond to them. And in any case, the issue is that he's talking about the dark period of the day of the Lord. The day starting in the evening and having the dark period first, and then the period of light afterwards. And in the scriptures, the darkness is a metaphor for bad things. And in this case, it's a metaphor for divine judgment upon the world that has been waiting and waiting and waiting for the development of the mystery of lawlessness to come to its head. So God has planned a heavy hand upon the whole world at a certain point in history when the mystery of the lawlessness finalizes, is brought to its peak, and Satan gets his man in place to rule, basically rule the world. And God's reaction to humanity in that is outlined in the book of the Revelation from chapters 4 through 19. A very heavy-handed reaction of judgment. So when Paul starts in verse 13, when he says, "But we should always give thanks to God for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God has chosen you from the beginning for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and faith in the truth," what he's doing is he's shifting the whole focus off of what God has planned for those who take pleasure in their unrighteousness, and he's fixing it on another group of people, you brethren, beloved by the Lord. And he's talking about the issue of people who are committed to the love of God and are committed to faith in the Spirit. And it's interesting that at the outset, the paragraph is deliberately focused on two issues: the grace of God and an obligation that stands over those who have received this grace. And since there's an enormous amount of confusion in Christendom about the relationship of grace to obligation, we're going to talk about it this evening, because there are two primary issues involved in Paul's statement. We're under obligation to always give thanks, which is a response to grace, to God because of what he's done. So one of the issues is, what is the obligation that grace brings to the table here? And why does Paul bring up that whole idea in the first place? I mean, why does he say we are under obligation to give thanks to God? Why didn't he just say we give thanks to God and go on about the... he said it over and over. His response to what God has done with the Thessalonians is a response of gratitude consistently, particularly through 1 Thessalonians. So we're going to look at those things. And the first one is the question of how grace is grace if it brings an obligation to the table. Because most of the time we've been taught that grace is God doing something for us without us having any meritorious base by which we might leverage God into doing it. It's not that he owes us anything at all. Paul said that in Romans 11. If the reward is of works, then it's no more of grace. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. So in that focus on the unmerited issue where God does for us something that we couldn't do and probably weren't even interested in having done until the crunch comes. I mean, everybody gets interested in having the solutions after the roof's fallen in. But because of the focus on lack of merit and all of that, and issues of obligation are typically legal, what is this? We're under obligation to give thanks to God. In what sense does grace bring an obligation to the table? And the first thing that I want to point out is that the we in verse 13, when he says, but we should also are under obligation to give thanks to God for you, that we is emphatic. We've mentioned this before, but Greek verbs don't require a pronoun or a noun to identify the subject of the verb because it's built right into the spelling of the verb. If it's a first person verb, the pronoun I is built right into the thing. If it's second person, the pronoun you is built right in there. He, she, or it, third person singular, it's built right into the way the verb is spelled itself. So unless you don't know what he's talking about in terms of a subject, you really don't need an additional, particularly pronoun, to be the subject of the verb. A lot of times you'll need a noun simply because you don't know what's doing the action of the verb, and you'll need a noun out there to do that. But in this case, the we is already built into the verb, so why does he emphasize that? It's an emphatic thing. Whenever an author adds an unrequired pronoun, it's always for emphasis' sake. He wants the readers to think about who the we are, and in this case, the we is Paul and Timothy and Silvanus. And they are, most critically, apostolic representatives of God in a world where their primary task as apostolic representatives of God is to establish the content of the faith. In other words, one of the issues of the gift of apostleship was the issue of establishing the content of the faith so that if you wanted to know what God had to say so that you could trust him, apostles and prophets were the two gifts that God gave to the church to establish the doctrinal content. It was the writings of the apostles and the writings of the prophets, and, of course, then the oral preaching that they did, too, that said, believe this and don't believe anything else. That's where we get our concept of the Word of God comes from the apostles. So when he says we, talking about himself and Timothy and Silvanus, in relation to the fact that he, at least, is an apostle. I don't know if you'd call Timothy and Silvanus apostles or not, but they're certainly involved in this representation of God through Paul. The whole idea there is that he is switching his focus, because one of the problems with the ungodly was in verse 10, they refused to embrace a love for the truth. They didn't care what was true. The only thing the wicked care about is whether they can get their way. And to them, truth is anything that they're told to do that will actually get them their way. And so even if you do something to get your way, and you have to run over somebody in the process or hurt them in the process, you sacrifice their well-being so you can have what you want. And a lot of times it doesn't even have anything to do with your well-being. It's just something you want. When that's going on, the whole issue there is they don't want to know what's true. Because if the truth gets stuck in there, they'll have to give up what they want. They'll have to say, oh, the truth is I can't be this kind of selfish and hurt somebody else and be involved in what's right and true. So don't tell me I can't do that, and off they go about their business. So when the issue is, in the near context, a love for truth, Paul identifying himself as an apostle and as such the source, the human source of the words of the doctrine of the faith, these people who love the truth are going to be influenced by what these truth bringers have to say. So that's why the emphatic we is there. We are under obligation. And there is this continuous, we are under obligation always. It's a continuous, ongoing obligation, and the verb indicates an ongoing action in the present time. There is an obligation that stands over the apostles as representatives of God's truth that says, because you received the grace of God in some form, you are now obligated to respond in a certain way. And, you know, that's really not as confusing as it, I mean, it shouldn't be as confusing as it is, because people say, well, if it's grace, you can't attach anything obligatory to it, or it's not grace anymore. If you have to do something after you've received this grace, then if you don't do it, what's going to happen? Is God going to rescind the grace? And if he rescinds it, then isn't the obligation a requirement for the grace? And if that's the case, then grace isn't grace anymore, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of the way the logic runs. And there's even a story in the scriptures where Jesus says to his audience in Matthew 18, I believe it is, he says, there was this guy that owed his master an enormous amount of money, and the Lord said to him, it's time for you to settle your debt. Pay me. And the guy fell on his knees and he, have mercy on me. I can't pay it now, but I'll pay it if you'll give me enough time. And he, you know. And so the master, just because he felt compassion, he just said, forget it. We'll just wipe the slate clean. I have compassion on you. We'll just wipe this debt out. So the guy gets up and he goes from being treated with compassion and mercy and grace, and he finds a guy that owes him some money and grabs him by the throat and shakes him and says, pay me what you owe me. And the guy says, oh, I will if you'll just give me time. I can't pay you today, but if you'll just give me time, I'll pay you. And he's got him around the throat saying, pay me, pay me, pay me. And so he has him thrown in prison until what he owes is paid. And the other servants of the Lord go to the Lord and say, you know, this is not right. You gave that guy a free walk. And he goes out, and for a whole lot less money, he has this guy in prison now because he can't pay his debt. And so the Lord calls the guy, and he's really, really, really angry. He says, you sorry, son, and so he revokes his dismissal of the debt and says, sell him, sell his family, sell his possessions until everything's paid. Put him in prison and let the tormentors at him until everything's paid. So here's a story, and Jesus says, this is the way my Father's going to treat you if you don't forgive those who sinned against you like you've been forgiven. So you have a story of rescinded grace. And because of that, there is this whole theological thing out there that says if you accept Jesus as your Savior and then you sin bad enough, you'll have your salvation rescinded and you'll be lost and you'll go to hell when you die because you didn't respond like you ought to. It's called losing your salvation. And so a lot of people are confused. What is this idea? And why does Paul bring it up here about an obligation? The issue of that Matthew 18 text frankly addresses the fact that grace imposed an obligation on this guy. The Lord was gracious to him, and he should have gone out and been gracious to the people that owed him money. But he wasn't. And because he wasn't, he made his master so angry that his master turned him over to the tormentors. So in our text, that whole idea that there is an obligation that has been established by the extension of grace received, and you have to ask yourself the question, well, what happens if I don't? I mean, what happens if Paul is under obligation to always be thankful to God for the Thessalonians, and he refuses to be? I mean, it's not likely to happen because Paul was tickled to death with the Thessalonians and their response to him and all that, but what would happen if he refused his obligation? That's the issue, and that's what's going on here in this text in terms of questions. So I think we need to talk about, what is the nature of the obligation, and how does grace relate to that obligation issue? Well, Paul actually calls it an obligation to respond to grace given by God, because that's what thanksgiving is. It's a response to give, to grace given. If somebody does a gracious thing to you, you owe them gratitude, in a sense. I mean, gratitude is the response to grace given. Here he calls it an obligation. And he actually tells us some things about that. Because what is he supposed to be grateful for? Well, he tells us in the middle of the verse. Because God has chosen you from the beginning for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and faith in the truth. And it was for this he called you through our gospel, that you may gain the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. So, because God chose these people from the beginning, Paul is under obligation to be grateful. I don't know if that clicks with your thinking or not, but that's what he declares. He says he stands under an obligation because of something God has done, and what God has done is extraordinarily grace-driven, because choosing somebody from the beginning, before they had done anything, before they even existed in history, and before they'd done anything good or bad, for God to have chosen them for salvation, and we'll talk about what that might mean in a little bit. But the fact that God makes these sovereign choices that affect people's lives for good, as well as perhaps not so much good, because, I mean, he's already decided or said what he's going to do to the people who didn't have any love for the truth, and you have to ask yourself the question, so how come I'm not going to get the hammer? Because all of us had a period in our lives when we weren't interested in the truth. So, here you have God making an elective choice, which is extremely gracious in the sense that these people didn't have any, they didn't deserve it. They hadn't done anything to deserve it before he made the choice, because it was from the beginning. So, he tells us that, but he also tells us what God's motivation in this whole process is, because he says we're obligated to give thanks to God for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord. Before he tells us what God has done, he tells us who these people are that he's obligated to be grateful to God for, and he calls them brethren, beloved by the Lord. And that means that he's telling us about the relationship issues, because he calls them brethren, meaning he considers them family in a very real sense, being born of the family of God, their family. So he has a natural inclination of a relationship with them because they're brethren, but also God loves them. And this whole issue of God's love for them is a very significant issue, because agape in the scriptures is the issue of deliberately selecting something in your value system and moving it up in terms of how valuable it is. If you take something that you love very much and then you demote it and say, well, I'm not going to care about that much anymore, as long as you care about it at all, you in a sense love it because you think it has value, but its value may be reduced. In other words, you may have thought it was worth a couple $1,000, and now you only think it's worth about 20 cents. That's a devaluation. As long as it's worth 20 cents, you still value it, but not. But in this case, being beloved by the Lord means that he has taken somebody that doesn't deserve to be loved at all, and he's moved them up the scale of value until it transcends his own value of his own relationship with his own son, because John 3:16 is going to come into the picture here. The love of God for human beings means the cross. And the cross means that the Trinity, the triune God, is going to be ripped by the insertion of death into the living God, so that sinners can be redeemed without justice being sacrificed. And all of that's an enormous sacrifice on God's part. So Paul calls them beloved by the Lord because they are. He's obviously moved them up the scale of value because of the price he was willing to pay for them. So, in the prior context, it said that in verse 10, these people that are deceived by the unrighteousness that they're engaged in, perish because they didn't receive love for the truth. In other words, they had taken the issue of truth in their value system and just pushed it down to where it had no value at all. It was actually below, and in fact, they hated the truth. They pushed it below the line. So because they had taken their love for truth and pushed it down below the line, God said, if they hadn't done that, I'd save them, because the love of the truth is so as to be saved, so that they could be saved. So in that sense, God had given them the truth because he loved them enough to want them to be saved. And they took his extension of grace in respect to the giving them the truth, and they said, I ain't interested. So, in a very real way, we have an illustration in verse 10 of God reacting to people who have had grace given to them, and they refuse the obligation that comes with it. Because if God graciously informs you of something that's true, you don't really have any business of ignoring it. You call him a liar if you don't accept it as truth, and if you don't believe that it's true, well, then there wasn't any point in him giving it to you. So, in this whole larger context, we have the issue of what happens when God extends grace and people, I mean, they're all of a sudden under obligation by grace. And they have something that they have to do because the grace was given. So, God loved those that are going to perish by giving them the truth, and they said, not interested, pulled it down below the line, hated it, didn't want to hear it. On the other hand, God did something that Paul considered an act of grace to him that required him to be grateful to God as a consequence. But what God actually did was he chose the Thessalonians from the beginning. And what did Paul have to do with that? I mean, how is this grace to Paul? That's what we're wrestling with. So, in the prior context of 2:10, where God says, those people are going to be deluded, and I'm going to make sure they're deluded because they don't like the truth. They didn't want to hear it, and they took pleasure in their unrighteousness, and so I'm going to pay them back according to their attitude and behavior. And since all of us, as I mentioned already, including the Thessalonians, at some point in our lives, we're not disposed within ourselves to love the truth. So if God had taken that attitude in our lives at that time and said, okay, I'm done with you, we would have never been given any further grace because we had said, not interested. And I know for a fact that I heard the gospel in more times than one in some revivals that my brother's girlfriend's mom took us to, because she was a good Baptist and, you know, Philip Pugh and Linda's got this boyfriend and his brother and some other people, and we're going to pack the pew with these boys. And so we'd go to these revivals and I'd hear a variation or some form of the gospel preached. And I remember sitting there feeling guilty as all good. I need to go forward. I need to respond. I need to do what the preacher's saying, but I need to get some things squared away first before I can do that. That was my thinking. That was my excuse. And what if God had said, okay, I'm done with you. You've heard it. You rejected it. You don't have any interest in the truth. You're out of here. Who of us couldn't have come under that kind of response by God, and including the Thessalonians? I mean, how is it that anybody ends up loving the truth when nobody loves the truth initially? We have to be drawn into that. There's a process where we have to come to where we say, oh, I need to know the truth because my life hinges on whether I'm believing the truth or not. And I really want not only my life to work well, but I want the God of truth to be pleased with the decisions I'm making. So I need to know the truth. But that's not the initial thing. And so the difference is this long-range plan of God that he has already been dealing with in chapter 2, is particularly when he talks about the mystery of lawlessness being at work from Genesis 3 for 6,000 years, allowing Satan to incrementally gain more and more followers of his deception until at the present time, he's got billions of human beings locked into his deceptions, and God is allowing this to happen over time. There's a restrainer, but he's not restraining the lie. He's just simply restraining how fast it grows. So in this context, there's this idea that there's a bigger issue here. It's bigger than just the Thessalonians. It's bigger than just the setting of the Thessalonians. It's about God's plan. And we're told, and I believe it's in the book of Hebrews, though I'd have to double check to be sure, but in the long range plan of God, he has this plan to bring many sons to glory. And in the plan to bring many sons to glory, he is constantly active. And the activity, according to the context here, has to have something to do with bringing people to the point where they want to know the truth. There has to be something that God does to cause a person who has no use for the truth because it gets in his way to realize that, you know, I've got to know the truth. This stuff I'm doing to other people because they're in my way, this may end up kicking me in the teeth. I need to know what's true. We had a couple that started coming to church in Jasper years and years ago, and he had been a truck driver until he got emphysema so bad he couldn't do anything but fish, which he enjoyed, but nonetheless, his life was a misery. And they didn't have much income, and neither one of them were very well educated. And I've been told so many times in my life, you just talk over our heads. I just don't understand what you're talking about. I'm a little gun shy about people who don't have much education, but this guy came to my office one day, and I just asked him, why are you coming here? And he said, well, all my life, I've heard about hell and heaven and all that stuff. And he said, I've gotten to the point where I want to know why. Why heaven? Why hell? What's going on? And he and his family came to church on a regular basis, constantly. And he started, and well, they started, at least he and his wife, his son was coming. But anyway, they started growing in their understanding of what the Bible has to say. And the reason was because they kept coming. And typically people will listen to me, and if I'm over their heads, I ain't listening to that anymore. I'm not going back. I didn't understand a thing he said. This family hung in there. Why? Well, apparently God had done something to say, you know, you need to know the whys, and you're going to have to put up with that guy up there long enough to learn it. So just, it was a development of the idea that in bringing many sons to glory, one of the things he's got to do is he's got to work in the hearts of those sons that he's going to bring to glory so that they want to know the truth so that they can be saved. That means that when he talks about being beloved by God or beloved by the Lord, he's talking about a group of people that God has set his affection on. He has said, you people are my beloved. And the outworking of that is, I'm going to underwrite for you, by grace, something that will cause you to start wanting to know the truth and start wanting to operate by a legitimate love. I'm going to do this. I'm a gracious God, and I'm going to do it for you. And Paul says that the beginning of that actually started from the beginning. Because any long-range plan requires a mastery of the details in the beginning. A lot of people get upset with the idea that God chooses people from the beginning for salvation, but they don't realize that all of the prophetic utterances of God in all of the Bible are statements about God saying, this I'm going to make happen. And he doesn't ask permission. He just says, I'm God. It's my creation. I'm going to make this happen. Every prophecy is like that. The only difference between that and God selecting somebody from the beginning is that it gets into the personal area where he's actually having to deal with created beings, people that he's choosing for salvation. And by implication, then, he's not choosing the others. That's what love is. It's choosing. Everybody that's ever gotten married knows that that's part of what it's all about. You can't just go around and say, well, I want to get married to all these girls. No, you can't. You got to choose one. Well, that wouldn't be fair to the others. you know, God's gift to your women is, you know, it wouldn't be fair to them. Well, fact is, you got to choose one. And when you do, you're going to elevate her above all the rest of them. And if you're going to be a man of integrity in any sense, you'll keep her there for the rest of your life. That's what love is. That's the way the Bible presents it. And this is part of the argument here, is that God has chosen somebody from the beginning for salvation. And if he's made that choice, it will happen. And Paul says, you Thessalonians are people whose behavior shows that you're that way. Because 1 Thessalonians 1:4 says, I know of your election by God. You've proven by your response to the gospel that you people were chosen by God from the beginning to this salvation. And I want you to know that, and I want you to know how that affects me. The bottom line of being loved is, the root of it is either I love that person because of something in that person, which would be typically a distortion. I love you because you do so this for me and this for me and this. I get this out of you, and that's why I value you so highly and so on. But all the way through the scripture says God's love doesn't look at it that way. God loves when you, there's nothing in the person to explain why he would love that person. He just does. So love is either rooted in the person that's being loved, or it's rooted in the person who's doing the loving, and it's not both. It's either or. And in the scriptures, God is the one who initiates the love issue. So you're beloved by the Lord. And the reason that he's saying that is because that's his motive. Love is his motive. And what is his action? What does his love motivate him to do? It motivates him to choose them from the beginning and then guarantee that that choice stays legitimate all through history until it comes their turn to live in history and then to work in their situation to bring them to a love for the truth and the knowledge of the gospel so they can be saved. And then after that, chapter 5, verses 23 and 24 of the first book, where he takes on their sanctification, says, I want that person in my kingdom in that place, and I'm going to make sure they're ready for it when they leave here. This is an issue that has to do with are getting a grip on what it means to hope. Because I've said this before, if our hope is rooted in the way we act, we're hopeless. I heard a sermon a couple weeks ago, well, probably last week, where the focus was on 1 Thessalonians 5, and it was do this, and 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 then finally verse 23 and 4 came up, and the summary of that was, and God's involved in your life. And I wanted to go back in my reaction to that. I wanted to go back and say, how can you preach do this, and do this, and do this, and do this, and Christianity is just really simple, just do this, and do this, because you don't do any one of those things consistently any time in your life. I'd have had him, because none of us do. Do you rejoice all the time? Do you give thanks all the time? Do you refuse to quench the spirit all the time? None of us do. That's the problem. And that's why we say it's a grace issue, and the choice has to be, the grace extension has to be a choice God makes. Now, the word that's actually used for choice here is only used three times in the New Testament, but in the other two cases, it's very clear that it means to make a decision to pursue a course of action. And that's why I said, you got to have the big picture in mind. God has decided he's going to bring many sons to glory. Is he going to leave the outcome of that decision up to them? Or is he going to actively initiate and produce the many sons that he's going to bring to glory? Because if he leaves it up to us, I'll guarantee you we'll mess it up. Now, the issue here is that his choices, he says, from the beginning. Now, that's an issue that's really problematic, because if you go back to the NA26 Greek text of the New Testament, you won't read from the beginning. You'll read aparkein, which means as a first fruit. And the editors of the Greek text say that Paul wrote, God chose you as a first fruit. But in spite of that, the New American Standard translators say, we're not going with that. And let me tell you why. The word apa is the Greek word for from, and the word arche is the word for beginning. So if you have apa plus arche, then it means from beginning. But in Greek grammar and syntax, if you have a word that ends in a vowel, which apa does, and then you have the next one that begins in the same, it's not the same vowel, but it's in the same group of vowels that have these characteristics. In other words, apa, arcane, one of them's an omicron, one is an alpha, but they sound so much alike that they're phonetically in this group. So when you have that, you drop the ending vowel off of the first word and put a little apostrophe there so that people know you've dropped something. And then you just run the words together. So you say, aparkane. Well, aparkane means from the beginning if it's two words. But aparkane without that little apostrophe is the word for first root. So apparently in some of the texts, the textual copyists, they saw op, arcane, and they just put it together. They conflated it, and they made it first root. But I didn't find the King James says from the beginning, the Old ASV says from the beginning, the NASB says from the beginning, and I quit looking after that. And the reason is because I think all of the translators realize that Paul's not talking about the Thessalonians being in a first root. Because in no way were they. They were not first fruits in any way. They weren't the first fruits of Achaia because he'd already been to Philippi. And there were some believers there, so the Thessalonians weren't first fruits there. They weren't like he talks about one person who was a first fruit in Asia. Well, that's the first guy who won the Lord in Asia, but the Thessalonians weren't. They were in no way a first fruit. They weren't the first fruit in relation to the church, because this is a second missionary journey. There's a whole bunch of believers that if there was a first fruits bunch, they'd already be there. So all of the translators recognize Paul couldn't possibly have said first fruit. He had to have said from the beginning. And that's the reason why we have the textual issue. But the whole point here is that Paul is simply giving the divine action from the divine motive. He loves them, and he has chosen them from the beginning. He has set his affection on them, and he is going to make what he has declared about them work throughout history until the kingdom of Messiah comes. And then it tells us that he's got a divine intention, because he says he's chosen you from the beginning for salvation. The issue of being chosen for salvation needs some clarity, because I don't believe that he's talking about the salvation that we talk about when we're talking about being justified. All the way through 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, the focus has been on, well, starting in 1 Thessalonians 1:10, 9 says, you turn from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait from his Son from heaven, who delivers us from the coming wrath. Delivers us from the coming wrath. That's the issue of salvation. The question is, what coming wrath is he talking about? Is he talking about Gehenna? Is he talking about hell? What? Well, it's interesting that in this context, in chapter 2, the coming wrath is the dark period of the day of the Lord. And the Thessalonians have been told, you are going to be subjected to the judgments of God that he has decided to pour out in the dark period of the day of the Lord upon the earth. You're going to be here and you're going to suffer them. And Paul says, that's not true. He said in verse 2, or that the day of the Lord has not come, and don't let anybody deceive you, because it's not going to come until a couple things happen. So the issue of the salvation that's involved in verse 13, being chosen from the beginning for this salvation, has to do with being delivered from having to be subjected to the dark period of the day of the Lord. That's what all of verses 1 to 12 in this paragraph are about. You guys quit worrying about this. This is not your destiny. The day of the Lord isn't going to even start until the disappearance happens. So God has chosen you to be a part of those who will be delivered either by death or rapture from the dark period of the day of the Lord and the judgments that will be poured out. God has chosen you from the beginning to make that happen, to deliver you from that judgment, to save you. So it's not the general salvation from sin by way of forgiveness of sins and new birth. It's the specific salvation the context is talking about. Being delivered from the judgment that God's going to pour out on this world in a heavy-handed, trip-hammer kind of awesome way that would terrify anybody that read and discovered that this is what God's going to do. Turn the Atlantic Basin into blood. Kill everything that's living in the whole Atlantic Ocean, north and south of the equator. Going to clog up all the machinery of the ships that sail in the Atlantic. Going to ruin them all. Everything in the Atlantic is going to die. He's going to turn the waters, the fresh waters of the earth to blood so that people can't find anything to drink. And that's just one or two of the things he's got laid out in Revelation 4 through 9. It's a horrible scenario. And anybody that reads it would say, oh God, deliver me from that. And deliver me means save me. So, the whole idea here is I believe the saving or the salvation is contextually defined. The issue is whether or not the Thessalonians are going to be subjected to the dark period of the day of the Lord. And salvation from those specific judgments is, I think, what 1 Thessalonians 1:10 clearly declares, and also here. So, that brings us back to the question. How does God's love, God's choice from the beginning, God's intention to deliver these people from the dark period of the day of the Lord, how does that bring Paul under obligation? How is he obligated to give thanks to God for that? I mean, if God had chosen him from the beginning and to deliver him from the day of the Lord, he could say, I'm obligated to thank God for delivering me from all this judgment. I didn't deserve to be delivered. I was a murderer. No. But I'm grateful that God has chosen me so that I won't have to do that, to experience that. I can see gratitude on that basis, but what is this gratitude because God chose the Thessalonians? Well, I think it runs along something like this. In his doctrine, he clearly teaches and he clearly understood that grace was supposed to have an impact. He told Titus that grace was to instruct us that denying ourselves, we should live godly, and so on. So grace has a designed intention of causing people's lives to change. He understood that he wasn't saved to sit around and do nothing. He wasn't designed to sit around and indulge himself in the daily pursuits of life in this world, because he told Timothy, no soldier entangles himself in the affairs of this life so that he can please the one who's called him to be a soldier. So as an apostle, he saw himself as under obligation to be an apostle. Grace had been extended to him, and it was extended in the form of God putting great favor on him, but also there is this obligation. Woe is me if I preach not the gospel, Paul said. Well, where's the woe coming from? It's coming from the idea that I have an obligation and I'm living under this obligation, and woe to me if I don't fulfill it. And also, 2 Timothy 2:10, Paul point blankly says at the end of his ministry, as he writes to Timothy, that everything he's endured in his whole lifetime of ministry, he has done for the sake of God's elect. Which means these people that have been chosen from the beginning, he has endured everything he's endured so that they can come to salvation. That's what he declares, 2 Timothy 2:10. Which means this, that he sees God's choice of the Thessalonians and his action on their behalf as an obligation to him, because God has given him the responsibility of preaching to these people so that the elect can come to salvation. So when God brings them to salvation through Paul's ministry, he sees that as a gracious thing for Paul. Because Paul said, who is our hope and joy, crown of rejoicing in the day of the Lord, Lord Jesus? You are. So if you're part of my reward, and God did that to you, he did it for my sake. Therefore, I'm under obligation to be grateful. And so, God's obligation on Paul is pretty simple. it was God's plan to put Paul into a gracious relationship with himself, to be an apostle. His salvation was to result in service to the living and true God and wait for him from his son from heaven. And that put him in the position of being God's instrument of salvation for all of the elect that would be influenced by his preaching and teaching and writing and all that. And God did all of that so that he could enhance Paul's participation after the judgment seat of Christ, the crown of rejoicing. That brings us back to the issue of what relationship does grace and obligation have to each other. And I think you need to keep two things in mind. One is, grace was never intended to erase obligation. It was intended to meet it. Grace was not intended to take the obligation of the fulfillment of all the laws in one sentence, love your neighbor as yourself. Grace was not intended to make you free from the obligation to love your neighbor as yourself. It was designed to enable you to do it. Obligation has never been dismissed. It's just been graciously provided a way so that it can be met. And I really believe that that's one of the things we need to keep clearly in mind, is that God doesn't erase obligation by giving us grace. The gift of grace means now you can meet it. Now you can actually meet it, not by yourself, but by the Spirit I've placed in you. You can meet the obligation because the grace is sufficient for you to do that. And then that raises the issue of the second thing, and that is, well, what if you don't meet your obligation? Well, let me just ask you this, who does? And if there's an answer to the who does, and the answer is, well, nobody really, well, then you have to start thinking, okay, then what is the Bible really saying here about grace in relation to obligation? I think it's saying this. There are two realms in which grace functions. One realm is the realm of the lost. Grace is extended to them, but if they refuse it, if they won't embrace the love of the truth, if they refuse the grace extended, God's reaction to them is going to be a reaction to people who have rejected his grace as unbelievers. And then there's this whole realm of the new relationship and the new family. God has all these people that he's birthed again, and he's made them part of the family of God, his family. They're actually chosen from the beginning, so he's going to keep them. He isn't going to toss any of them back. And that means then that you have to make a distinction in your thinking about how God treats people who never love the truth and how God treats his own children who sometimes love the truth and sometimes don't, because we haven't arrived yet. We're imperfect in a lot of things. And the difference between how God addresses the issues of grace and law in relation to the world. The law says you better be perfect or God's going to reject you if you approach him on the basis of the law and apart from grace. And God says, that's right. You try to earn your salvation and you'll never make it. But on the other hand, he extends grace to people and they believe him and he gives them eternal life and makes them a part of his family. But they're still involved in the human weaknesses. And so he makes adjustments for that, but with this realization that he told the Galatians, don't get in the habit of sowing the wrong kind of seed. You will reap what you sow. So if grace has obligated you, meet the obligation by the grace provision that God has made. God gave us the Spirit to dwell in our bodies to enable us to live for him. That's what he's calling us to do.